It starts with not attending that game. It starts with potentially reconsidering where you put your dollars.
Pride night at the baseball game. A big league player talks exclusively to EWTN News in depth about his objection to an anti-Catholic trans group invited to appear at Dodger Stadium. That plus a conversation with two organizations that accompany Catholics with same-sex attraction to bring them closer to Christ.
No one understands a priest like another priest. And it applies to us as bishops. No one really understands the role of a bishop like another bishop does.
And nearly 200 Catholic bishops from around the United States gathered to talk about the most important issues facing the faithful in America, full coverage of their agenda, and how they hope to address the needs of parishioners entrusted to their care. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
It's a blatant anti-Catholic message that they're sending, regardless of how much, you know, quote unquote, good they've been doing in their community.
A Major League Baseball player who says his Catholic faith is more important than his life as an athlete goes public with his opposition to a Pride Night celebration at Dodger Stadium. The event includes a group of so-called transgender nuns he says make a mockery of his religion. June is Pride Month across the country, a secular event celebrating the rights and culture of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people who have struggled to overcome prejudice and be accepted for who they are. But a Pride event at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles involving a group called the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, whose members dress up like nuns, has drawn criticism across the spectrum. First, from some Roman Catholics and politicians when the group was invited to participate in Pride Night, and then outrage from the gay community when the Dodgers canceled their participation. Bending to pressure, the Dodgers apologized and invited the group back to Pride Night happening this weekend. The Dodgers will be giving the trans nuns a Hero Award for their work in the queer community. The group's website says its members have devoted themselves for decades to community service, ministry, and outreach to those on the edges by promoting human rights, respect for diversity, and spiritual enlightenment. But the members are also known for dressing up as religious sisters, performing sexualized scenes of Christ's passion, obscene depictions of Jesus, and mocking Catholic sacraments, including the Eucharist and confession. However, they claim they are not anti-Catholic.
None of the sisters come from a place of hate, and we are not anti-religion. We are not anti-Catholic. We would never tell a person that you cannot worship or believe anything. If you find a faith or something to believe in that gives you hope and brings you peace, please go for it. Like, that's important, because without faith, what do you have? Faith gives you hope, and without hope, what's the purpose?
We spoke with a consecrated sister who, like other women religious around the world, spent many years in formation and study before taking her vows. Sister Lisa Marie Doty of the Canosian Daughters of Charity shared her thoughts about the group that mocks the very vocation she took.
It's not a title any of us take for ourselves. It is always given from another, not to honor us, but to help others to recognize who we are. So when we begin to use that title freely of anyone, just dressing up in a certain way, calling themselves a nun, I take a little bit of an offense to that, and not just for myself, but for all the religious who have dedicated their lives of allowing others to send them, you know, to the service of others.
In response to the Dodgers' decision to include the group in its Pride Night celebration, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles wrote, "Honoring a group that mocks women religious and, worse, desecrates the cross, profanes the Eucharist, and disrupts Holy Mass has caused disappointment, dismay, and pain in our Catholic community." The statement goes on to say, quote, "The Archdiocese of Los Angeles stands for the gospel of Jesus Christ, which means we stand against any form of bigotry, hate, or sacrilege. And on behalf of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, its president, Archbishop Timothy Broglio, joined by Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York and Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez, released this statement. This year, on June 16th, the day of the Solemnity of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, a professional baseball team has shockingly chosen to honor a group whose lewdness and vulgarity in mocking our Lord, His mother, and consecrated women cannot be overstated. This is not just offensive and painful to Christians everywhere, it's blasphemy. It has been heartening to see so many faithful Catholics and others of goodwill stand up to say that what this group does is wrong, and it's wrong to honor them." The USCCB called on all Catholics to pray the Litany of the Sacred Heart on June 16th. In their words, quote, "As an act of reparation for the blasphemies against our Lord we see in our culture today." An outspoken critic from the sports world joins the bishops in their denunciation of what is happening Friday night at Dodger Stadium. Major League pitcher Trevor Williams, a devout Catholic who plays for the Washington Nationals, sent out this tweet calling out the Dodgers organization for including the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence in its Pride Night lineup. His Twitter comments have been viewed more than 19 million times. Williams sat down and spoke about his decision to go public with his criticism in an exclusive interview for EWTN News In Depth with reporter Colin Flynn. Here's the first part of that conversation. Trevor Williams joins us on the record.
Trevor Williams, great to meet you, and thank you so much for doing this interview.
Good meeting you as well. Thank you.
Your tweet that went viral all over the world, almost 20 million views. It's a long statement, but I'll just read a short piece from it now. You said, "As a devout Catholic, I am deeply troubled by the Dodgers' decision to reinvite and honor the group, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, at their Pride Night. To invite and honor a group that makes a blatant and deeply offensive mockery of my religion and the religion of over 4 million people in the Los Angeles County alone undermines the values of respect and inclusivity that should be upheld by any organization." And like I said, that's been read 19 million times. Trevor, why did you feel so strongly that you wanted to make that statement?
It had to be said. We cannot stand idly by while our Lord gets mocked. And before I hit send, you know, you try and do as much research as you can, right? You see the horrific videos that were posted of them. You read about what they were trying to do. These things that are deeply offensive to us. And then you see that, well, they're doing these things. They're raising money for this, that, and the other. They've been doing it for over 30 years. But it was the point when the Dodgers re-invited them after knowing very well what they've been doing for the last 30 years.
To give them a community hero award.
Correct. And at that point, I looked at the Dodgers code of conduct. I'm like, look, or the Dodgers fan code of conduct. And it said, you cannot wear anything or say anything that goes against anybody's age, gender, creed, religion. And at that point, it was like, this is going against their code of conduct. It's a blatant anti-Catholic message that they're sending, regardless of how much, you know, quote unquote, good they've been doing in their community. But when I saw how deeply offensive it was, doing awful things to the cross, doing awful things about Stations of the Cross, like, it's just, it became a point where these negatives they shouldn't be honored, and they shouldn't mock a certain group.
Because you did say in that statement as well that you believe all groups should be welcomed and respected when it comes to Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. So this group specifically, the group who call themselves the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, mm-hmm. what is it, if we get to the core of it, that you believe is mocking your Catholic faith?
Yeah, I think if anyone with two eyes and a brain can see that they're mocking the religious habits of nuns. They're mocking what we hold most deeply, and what are our core convictions? They're blatantly mocking it. When you look at it from the outside in a totally objective view, it's blatant mockery.
Now, the group who called themselves the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, they released a statement. It was before your statement, but in response to the backlash from Catholics. They said that they're not anti-Catholic, but they're an organization based on love, acceptance, and celebrating human diversity. And in terms of dressing up in drag and mocking Catholic nuns, the group said that its members use humor and irreverent wit to expose the forces of bigotry, complacency, and guilt that chain the human spirit. Mm-hmm. What do you think of their response?
If they are preaching these things on tolerance and love, you could look at this from an objective point of view and say this isn't out of love. When you go out of your way to desecrating a crucifix or, you know, dancing on what appears to be Jesus on a cross, that isn't
representing
out of love.
The crucifixion, the most important moment for Christians all over the world.
And what we hold to most dear, we look at the cross and the crucifixion and we see that Jesus dying for us and his blood soaking us and washing us of our sin. And for someone to do that because they say it's art and it's out of love and tolerance, it doesn't make sense.
Trevor, do you see hypocrisy here when you look at how Catholics are treated in the United States? Because if you just imagine a group making fun of a Jewish rabbi and the Torah, or a Muslim and the Quran, what the reaction would be to that?
I would hope that they wouldn't be allowed at that stadium. I would hope. But there seems to be this, it's okay to make fun of Christianity in general and Catholicism in particular.
20 million views, almost 19 million views. Are you surprised by how many people have read and engaged with the statement that you put up on Twitter?
You know, my intention with that statement was to get as many eyeballs on it as possible and for people to see the hypocrisy that I was trying to point out of what the Dodgers were doing. And, I hit send tweet and I threw my phone and I was like, I logged out and I'm like, we'll see how it does. We'll see how it does. And but I've had a lot of people come out and reach out to me, former teammates, current teammates, even like stadium workers. When we were at Dodger Stadium, when this statement was made, just walking through the tunnels, getting to the clubhouse, I had stadium workers come up to me and thank me. So a lot of people have reached out thanking me for my courage and thanking me for making the statement, because a lot of people feel like they either don't have a big enough voice to say something, or they are afraid of the backlash.
When you speak about the backlash and having courage to do this, most of the people, if you read through the comments, are supporting you. But then there are those who are saying things like homophobic and transphobic, and you just have a problem with that, the LGBT group. First of all, what do you say to those accusations?
I didn't say anything anti-pride in my statement. I tried to be as charitable as possible. I truly just wanted to point out the hypocrisy that the Dodgers Code of Conduct says. You cannot make fun of a group, yet we're honoring this group at the expense of making fun of this group.
Yeah, so your issue is with the mockery they're making of your faith.
Correct. And the mockery of it, and then the Dodgers not upholding, not following their own rules. So that was truly my statement. If you read into it any other way, that's on you. But
were you afraid of the possible ramifications of being canceled? We see people lose everything over a tweet or an opinion that they put online. You were putting your neck out there when a lot of other players are not. Were you worried?
I wasn't necessarily worried, because this is something that I believe is truth, right? And it's something that this is Trevor the Catholic Man tweeting this. What I did, I believed was true, and I had to stick up for our truth. And at the end of the day, baseball is important, and it's given me a lot of tremendous opportunities. It's a privilege to play this game, and I'm thankful for everyone who's given me an opportunity. But when I die, hopefully in a state of grace, and St. Peter greets me at the gates, he's not going to ask what your win-loss record was in 2023. He's just going to, how did you build the kingdom of heaven? And being in a position like this, being a Major League Baseball player, and my religion being mocked in the realm of Major League Baseball, it only made sense to stick up for my truth.
Colm will be back with more of his interview with Trevor Williams later in the program. But first, a deeper dive into the issue of how the Catholic Church can best approach Pride Month, keeping in mind church teaching on sexual identity, but compassion and support for Catholics who experience same-sex desires. And we're joined now by Father Paul Scalia, Episcopal Vicar for Clergy for the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia. He's been involved with Courage International, an organization that ministers to Catholics who experience same-sex attraction but want to remain true to church teaching. Father Scalia, it's so great to be with you. You worked with Courage International ministering to young people who suffer from gender discordance or feel that they are attracted to the same sex. How do this month's Pride celebrations affect them?
Yeah, that's a great question, because most everybody thinks that, you know, if a person has same sex attractions, then, you know, they're celebrating during Pride Month. But no, the members of Courage, I think this is a very difficult month for them, because at the heart of Pride Month is the claiming of an identity, really. And the whole project of the members of Courage is to go deeper in their true identity as children of God, and not to identify themselves just according to their sexual attractions or inclinations. And so, yeah, it's a very difficult month. It becomes more difficult, I think, when some church officials are not as clear on things. But certainly in the secular world, it's very difficult. And in the workplace and in stores and things like that, it all kind of piles up.
And you mentioned the church officials who are unclear. I'd love to ask you about that specifically. How does that affect those who identify as LGBTQ, who love the church and want to be a part of it? What effect have you seen that has when people are unclear or advocating to change church teaching from as a church leader perspective?
Yeah, it's a source of great discouragement, because I mean, here's a group of men and women who are striving to live according to the truth of our human nature, according to the truth of the gospel, and at great sacrifice to themselves a lot of the time, and involving great struggle. And so when things are not presented clearly, or even when, you know, corners are cut, that's a discouragement to them. And all the more reason for us to, you know, voice our support for those who really are striving for chastity.
Well, someone who is not cutting any corners and being very clear is Washington Nationals' Trevor Williams, who came out with a statement on the LA Dodgers issue, them honoring the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, who are not sisters at all. How do you suggest families navigate these pride parades or pride celebrations or boycotts of them, especially in light of this LA Dodgers issue?
Yeah, it's a difficult thing. I mean, you can't go to the stadium on Pride Night, right? I mean, it's not going to send the right signal. Avoiding these things, the public, you know, parades or whatever else. It's a very difficult thing for families to navigate, because you want to always communicate that we love everyone, and everyone possesses a certain dignity, because every person is created in the image and likeness of God. And so we don't bear ill will towards anyone or malice towards anyone. At the same time, we can't approve all things. The things that are advocated and celebrated during Pride Month can't be approved. And so, you know, it just speaks to the need for strong, healthy families where these conversations can be had, and where the children feel comfortable enough raising it, and the parents feel secure enough addressing it forthrightly and, you know, in an appropriate manner and everything. But it's certainly in the family that's, I think, where those foundations are laid so that children can navigate this well and understand the difference between loving a person and really desiring good for another person, while at the same time not agreeing with the person and not endorsing what the person insists be endorsed.
Right. Truth with compassion. Father Scalia, we were asked to pray by the USCCB, by Archbishop Rolio and many others, these prayers, this litany to the Sacred Heart and reparation. Can you explain how that works? Reparation to the Sacred Heart of Jesus.
Right, right. It's well, we did this after every one of our masses this today at the parish. The celebrant just led the congregation in the litany of the Sacred Heart. Well, you know, the devotion to the Sacred Heart just focuses on, first of all, the fact that he loves us and that we need to love him in return. And part of loving a person is consoling that person when that person's been hurt or offended. And so one of the principal messages of the revelations to St. Margaret Mary about the Sacred Heart is our Lord's desire for reparation, his desire to be consoled for all of the offenses and blasphemies and sacrileges that he suffers. And so it falls to those who are devoted to the Sacred Heart to go to him and to basically to say, in place of others who have shown you disrespect or offense or blasphemy or sacrilege, I'm here to say that I love you. And I'm here to show you my devotion and to give you my heart as fully and as purely as I can. That's a manner of consoling his Sacred Heart, of bringing him some consolation. And maybe one way of thinking about it, just sort of an imaginary prayer, is thinking about going and consoling our Lord in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he is there, you know, taking upon himself, taking into his heart, really, all of the offenses, all the sins throughout the world, yours and mine and everyone's, and going there and just being with him. Because we all know just somebody being with us makes an enormous difference when we are suffering.
Being with him in his suffering and offering ourselves and our love for him. I love that. One last quick question. The technical calling the sisters, sisters, we have sisters who are who take that as their vocation, and then we have these sisters of the perpetual indulgence. Give us a little bit of clarity around that. Should we be calling them sisters?
I mean, that's the way they identify themselves, and I mean, that's their moniker. It's offensive. And listen, if this were done to any other religious group, there would be a huge outrage. If this were done to a Muslim group or Jewish group, people would be furious. But for some reason, we hear nothing but crickets in the secular world. People don't mind that really one of the most sacred things in the Catholic faith is being ridiculed. That is consecrated women religious. And so it's offensive in the extreme. I mean, we call them sisters of perpetual indulgence because that's how we identify the people who are doing these things that are so offensive. But I mean, obviously they're not any sisters in any way, shape or form.
Well, I'm grateful for your clarity, and I know that the rest of our audience is too. And we're grateful for your ministry, Father Scalia.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Same here. Thank you so much.
Happy feast day.
Happy feast day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There's much more ahead on EWTN News In Depth. Pope Francis is released from the hospital more than a week after surgery. And we head to Florida for some high-level discussions.
Here in sunny Florida, U.S. Catholic bishops have gathered for their annual summer meeting. They're talking about the Synod on Synodality, upcoming World Youth Day, and the Eucharistic Revival in America. I'm Mark Irons with an update from Orlando.
The leaders of the Catholic Church in America have wrapped up their annual spring meeting. Bishops from across the country cast votes on several matters that will impact upcoming major events in the life of the church. Reporter Mark Irons has the details.
Opening in song, the meeting of American Catholic bishops kicked off with a message on behalf of Pope Francis from Archbishop Christoph Pierre. The Vatican ambassador to the U.S. spoke about the vital need to bring Christ to all people.
Where Christ is not already known and loved, we must put him there by our own presence.
In sunny Orlando, Florida, where the bishops gathered this week, Archbishop Pierre spoke about the ongoing Synod on Synodality, a worldwide church initiative led by Pope Francis with an emphasis on listening, especially to the laity.
The baptized should always feel welcome to speak what they think in Christ.
Bishop Daniel Flores has helped lead U.S. involvement in the Synod process. It will culminate with a gathering of Catholic bishops, priests, religious, and lay people this October in Rome.
It's not just a one-time event. I think what the Holy Father would like this Synod to do is to kind of become the impetus by which the local churches, especially in the Latin West, learn how to locally engage their people more practically to hear mostly what their concerns and priorities are.
One concern and priority for U.S. bishops is promoting greater love for the Eucharist. They're inviting parishes all over the country to take part in the ongoing Eucharistic revival.
Right now, we're at a pivotal moment. We're about to begin the parish year, one of the most important moments of our revival. And this is our chance, really, to go much deeper into the grassroots than we've done so far.
Bishop Andrew Cousins says the ongoing initiative is about starting a fire to spark greater devotion to Christ truly present in the Eucharist. Dallas Auxiliary Bishop Greg Kelly told us upon receiving the Eucharist, lay Catholics then have a mission to bring Christ to others.
The Eucharist, you know, is at the heart of our life as Catholics, but to truly understand that the real presence is not just a belief in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, but also as we receive him, to bring that real presence out into the world, you know, embodied in our voices and our faces and our what we do and what we're willing to suffer.
In between the meetings, bishops spent time for prayer in this conference center. Space is converted to an adoration chapel and a gathering space for daily mass. At the Orlando meetings, bishops also voted on a number of agenda items, including the approval of liturgical text, a national pastoral plan for Hispanic ministry, and a plan to proceed with a document revision on ethical and religious directives for Catholic healthcare services. Amid concerns and questions about the role of Catholic hospitals and opposition to providing transgender surgical operations,
it might be necessary to include specific guidance concerning radical modifications of the human body, such as are widely advocated in practice today for the treatment of those suffering from gender dysphoria.
They also approved a plan to begin the process of drafting a new pastoral statement addressing persons with disabilities in the life of the church. We asked the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Archbishop Timothy Broglio, if the statement could lead to greater resources for Catholic schools and churches to serve those with disabilities.
Certainly, I think there is a hope that there will be more concrete resources available for persons with disabilities. I think we also want to address the issues of how we teach the faith to people with disabilities as well.
And the bishops are acknowledging holy lives. They voted to move ahead with a cause that could lead to sainthood for the Shreveport martyrs. Five Catholic priests who died during a yellow fever epidemic in the late 1900s as they ministered to the sick in Shreveport, Louisiana. The Bishop of Shreveport told us the example of their sacrifice continues to inspire.
They not only ministered diligently to the sick in the community, but they wound up ministering to each other. They were the local heroes for the community.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
For more insight into the key developments this week at the bishops' meeting, we turn to Dr. Matthew Bunsen, editorial director for EWTN News. Matthew was also in Orlando covering the meeting for EWTN. It's great to see you again, Matthew. What does this vote on the ethical directives for hospitals mean, and what can we expect next? This is about transgender care, right?
To a large degree, it is. Bishop Flores, who's in charge of the committee that's now tasked with coming up with the draft for the revision, recognized the fact that this particular section of the directives, Part 3, which is the patient-healthcare provider or patient-hospital relationship, that these directives haven't really been updated since 1994. And as we all know, there has been a massive sea change in so many of the realities that the healthcare providers are facing and the pressures, especially today with transgender ideology. So that's one of the keys, I think, in this discussion. How it goes forward now is going to be the question, because the bishops, probably the most aggressive of their conversation today in amongst themselves, addressing this question of a draft, want broad and wide consultation among healthcare providers. And as I think it was Cardinal Tobin from Newark pointed out, we also need to listen, he said, to members of the trans community in order to get their input. So we'll have to see where the bishops go with that. But the task now is to get a draft created to be looked at by the bishops. But that, based on the conversation today, is going to take some time.
Was there any mention of those who regret their transitions or regret any kind of impact of this kind of care?
No, but I think one of the aspects that these directives are going to have to touch on is the deep sensitivity of the human person, recognizing on the part of healthcare providers, Catholic hospitals, the human person made in the image and likeness of God, And that's going to be, I think, an important element here, especially if the request has been made for broad and wide consultation.
And it looks like Bishop Flores is aware that they're going to have to be very specific. What kind of impact will the statement on disabilities have, and why was that brought up in this session? What was the impetus for that? Really quick.
Yeah, well, in much the same way that it's been many, many years since we had the revision of the Part 3 of the healthcare directives, it's been 45 years since the bishops issued a statement on people with disabilities in the life of the church. That was, in fact, before the passage of the American Disabilities Act in 1990. So Bishop Barron, who's in charge of this process, said that we need to have a new draft in order to reflect the language that we have today, but also the many challenges that exist for those with disabilities in the United States and beyond.
And the possible new resources. Thank you so much, Matthew.
Good to be with you.
Top headlines are next. In the Week in Review, Pope Francis is released from the hospital. A boat packed with hundreds of refugees meets a tragic end. And a major setback for women clergy in the country's largest Protestant denomination. We'll be right back. News about the Pope's health tops the Week in Review. The Holy Father joyfully left the hospital on Friday morning after a nine-day stay following abdominal surgery. Pope Francis was greeted by well-wishers after being discharged from Gemelli Hospital in Rome. More than a week before, he underwent a three-hour surgery to remove painful scar tissue in his intestines and repair an abdominal hernia. His surgeon said Francis had no complications and is, in fact, in better shape than before.
Now, he will no longer have discomfort, the medical ailments he had before. He will be a stronger Pope. He will not have a period of convalescence. He has already started working. We asked him to take it easy for a bit, but I am sure that this time he will listen to us a little more because important commitments await him. And he has already said that he will be attending all of them in person.
Before returning to the Vatican, Pope Francis stopped to pray and give thanks before the icon of the Virgin Mary at St. Mary Major Basilica. The pontiff stops here to pray before and after all his papal trips. He also prayed here after his discharge from the hospital in April, following treatment for bronchitis. He was greeted by crowds outside as he left and headed back to his office and living quarters at the Vatican. As the Pope continues his recovery at home, preparations continue for World Youth Day, scheduled to take place at the beginning of August in Lisbon, Portugal. The site where thousands are expected to converge remains under construction. Organizers call it a meeting of the Pope with the young people of the world. And if there were no papal presence, they say there will be no event. Lisbon's mayor expressed his optimism this week that all will go according to plan.
The Pope is getting better. The news is good. And therefore, we have only one plan. Plan F, which is the Pope Francis plan. Pope Francis will come to Lisbon, and we will have a great World Youth Day here. And that is what we are working on. We are not working on any other scenario. This is the scenario that the City Council is working on, and this is the scenario that will happen.
World Youth Day is held internationally every 2 or 3 years. It was originally begun by Pope St. John Paul II in the mid-1980s. More than 500,000 young people have already registered for this August event in Lisbon. Horror on the Mediterranean Sea. More than 75 people have died. Hundreds are still missing after a boat crammed with migrants capsized on Wednesday. Rescuers were able to save 104 people. Testimonies from survivors say 100 children were below deck. The fishing boat was headed from Libya to Italy when it sank off the coast of Greece. The Coast Guard, Navy, and merchant vessels and aircraft fanned out for a vast search and rescue. The tragedy has focused attention on efforts by the European Union to crack down on illegal migration using bilateral agreements with nearby countries.
This is yet another example of the need of member states to come together and create orderly, safe pathways for people forced to flee and for comprehensive action to save lives at sea and reduce perilous journeys.
Earlier in the month, European Union countries made what EU officials considered a breakthrough in migration talks, sealing an agreement on a plan to share responsibility for migrants entering Europe without authorization, the root of one of the bloc's longest-running political crises. A win for Native Americans. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the Indian Child Welfare Act. In a 7-2 decision written by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, the court supported the 1978 federal law prioritizing placement of adoptive Native American children with Native American families. Over the decades, adoption agencies removed hundreds of thousands of Native Americans from their homes, placing them in group settings or with white families with no connection to their culture. The case, Holland versus Brackeen, petitioners claim the law unconstitutionally discriminates based on race. But the tribes said they're formed as political entities, not racial entities, and that doing away with that distinction would impact every aspect of Indian law and policy. The country's largest Protestant denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention, took a strong stance this week at its annual meeting, voting to ban female pastors and expel two prominent churches with ordained women preachers. The issue of female pastors had not been voted on in more than 20 years, but a conservative faction within the Baptist Convention has been working in recent years to draw brighter lines around gender leadership in the church. It was a setback for the prominent Baptist preacher Rick Warren, author of the best-selling Christian book, The Purpose-Driven Life, whose megachurch has now been expelled because it has a women associate pastor. This amendment to the Southern Baptist Convention's constitution, with stricter guidance about women's roles, must be approved one more time next year before it's final. Some encouraging news about an apparently rebounding American economy. For the first time in 15 months, the Federal Reserve this week skipped a rate hike, leaving it at about 5.1%. And year-over-year consumer inflation fell to its lowest rate in 2 years. Though still above the central bank's 2% target, inflation is way below its recent peak. A situation that could have presented a disaster for supply chain issues all up and down the East Coast has a quicker solution than first expected. Last weekend, a fiery gas truck crash caused a bridge to collapse on busy I-95 in Philadelphia. The driver was killed, and initial speculation was that it would take months to repair the bridge, interrupting the flow of commercial products on one of the busiest highways in the country. But this week, engineers suggested another approach to getting traffic flowing. Before rebuilding the overpass, work crews will first use recycled glass nuggets to fill in the collapsed area and build a temporary roadway out of it.
This approach will allow us to avoid delays due to shipment and supply chain issues and pursue a simple, quicker path. Once complete, cars and trucks can return to this stretch of 95, and then we will work together to build a permanent bridge while making sure we keep 6 lanes of traffic open at all times that road construction, that bridge construction goes on.
U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg toured the bridge collapse site earlier in the week. Without a quick reopening of the busy I-95 corridor, he warned the cost of impacted goods would go up because of shipping disruptions. Pennsylvania's governor says construction crews will be on site 24 hours a day, every day, until the work is completed. EWTN News In Depth is back in a moment.
They begin to see themselves as God sees them. They see themselves as a beloved son, as a beloved daughter, as sufficient in the eyes of God.
Next, more about Catholics growing their relationship with the church while struggling with same-sex attraction. Resources and insights up next. The Catholic Church recognizes the dignity of every human being. So while we bring you coverage of honors given to a group that mocks Catholicism and the reaction that followed, we take a step back from the outrage to focus on the Church's pastoral guidance on people with homosexual leanings and those with gender discordance. Last month, Archbishop Paul Coakley of Oklahoma released a pastoral letter calling on all Catholics to support a consistent view of human sexuality, but reminding all faithful that we are all loved by our Creator and called to holiness. We spoke with leaders of two ministries that help share the truth of original personhood with those who identify as LGBTQ.
Everybody has struggles here and there, but what we see is that as they begin to submit themselves to the Lord, frequent the sacraments, and give themselves sacrificially in spiritual fatherhood and spiritual motherhood in their communities, there's a great healing, a healing of deep wounds.
Courage International ministers to those who experience same-sex attractions.
Well, in 1980 or so, Cardinal Terence Cook was looking around in New York at the AIDS crisis and the individuals who were trying to live their faith who were in the gay community. And he said, we need to find some sort of way of ministering to these people who desire to have, you know, the fullness of their faith and also struggle with this particular thing.
The organization has chapters in 14 countries around the world, providing support for those who want to live in accordance with church teaching, grow spiritually, and serve God.
The individuals get together and they go through the goals and they kind of check in to see how they're living. They build each other up, and then they have a priest chaplain who can hear confessions and help guide them in that.
Members are asked to practice 5 goals, including living chastely, receiving the sacraments, fostering fellowship so they know they're not alone, forming chaste friendships, and being a good role model.
They live a very countercultural life, and yet they do it with great charity and great love.
Another program, Eden Invitation, is relatively new.
We have small groups, we have retreats, an online community, and local chapters.
Founded in 2018, it is an outreach to young adult Catholics who have an LGBTQ+ experience.
I can build friendships with people who really understand what I'm going through, who understand my experiences, and that God can meet me in this place, right?
Anna Carter, the organization's founder, says one of the goals is to provide hope that all have a future in the church.
We're really trying to provide a communal space within that church context, right? Within fidelity to the church, to her moral teachings, to her anthropological teachings.
Carter says Eden Invitation also allows those who experience discordance of sexuality and gender to open up to their families and friends about this vulnerable part of their life.
I do think our experiences of sexuality, our experiences of gender, they do affect us at our deepest core. But most fundamentally, the identity that is the most foundational is the one that I receive from God, right? Who made me in his image and likeness, and who calls me to become like himself, who adopts me into his family through my baptism.
Both Eden Invitation and Courage International follow a model of accompaniment.
Like our Lord, in the road to Emmaus, you know, he comes to his disciples, right? And he says, what's going on? Right? He doesn't say, well, you're wrong. You don't understand the scriptures. Here's how it's supposed to be. He says, well, what's going on? Tell me your story. Tell me about what went on. And then he opens the scriptures and says, and so when you say these things, do they fit with this?
This model of accompaniment in Courage International expanded, offering programs for families called Encourage. The apostolate provides guidance for parents, siblings, and other family members to support loved ones who experience same-sex attractions.
And so we work with the family members to try and help them kind of cope with that, but also, encounter that person in a loving way, right? So that the person knows that they're loved, but also receives the truth.
Truth, but with compassion. Compassion, both leaders say, is vital to all outreach to those with gender discordance or same-sex attractions.
We need to be willing to sit with them, right, and walk with them in the midst of their growth in virtue.
To learn more about Eden Invitation and Courage International, visit the websites listed on your screen.
I think there is a longing for truth. I think everyone has that desire to find truth.
When we return, more from our interview with Major League Baseball player Trevor Williams as he takes us on his own personal faith journey. We'll be right back. Earlier in this program, we brought you an exclusive interview with Washington Nationals pitcher Trevor Williams as he talked to us about his concerns about the Pride Night celebration at Dodger Stadium. We continue the story now with a look at this young man's strong Catholic convictions and how they've become a bedrock of his life. Back to Colin Flynn's interview with Trevor Williams in this Faith Journey in Depth report.
So let's find out a bit more about you, Trevor, to get to the heart of where you're coming from. Because people here in the US will know you from their TV screens, from going to games to see you. And when people see you in the long hair and the tattoos, are they surprised when they find out that you're a man of faith?
Not always, you know, because I always would get teased like, oh, here comes Jesus into the cafeteria, you know, the long hair and the beard kind of,
yeah,
you get that look.
But are you trying to emulate the look?
I try as best as I can to emulate the look. But no, I think it's something that... It's a good conversation starter, right? You know, why do you have a raven on your arm? Do you love Edgar Allan Poe? It's like, no, not necessarily, but like I love...
Because you've got a few religious tattoos on your arm.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, let me talk about St. Benedict of Nursia and why I have a raven on my arm. So it's hard for me to evangelize. I'm not a good icebreaker, but when people come and ask about, you know, why do you have lilies on your arm? Well, let me tell you about St. Joseph and why I need help as a husband and father. It helps. So I think, you know, do I look like... you know, the best Catholic in the world? No, obviously, like, but it's something that I love, and it's a part of my identity as a Catholic man, and it's something that I like to talk about.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in San Diego, California.
And when you grew up, was it in a Catholic family? Was it always there from the beginning?
Yeah, so I grew up going to church every Sunday. It wasn't until youth ministry that it started to make more sense. The biggest question that rocked me when I was young was like, every decision you make is either going to destroy the kingdom of heaven or build it up. And it's like, how do you now?
Yeah, but as a young person, how do you get to that point where you're thinking in terms of the kingdom of heaven? I mean, was there a moment when you thought this is true, this is real, as opposed to just going to Mass on Sunday because you had to?
Yeah, I think it was that, those questions being asked, and then also my first time in adoration, I think, was the first time where... in silence, you hear the voice of God, or you see and you adore our Creator, and the King of the universe is right there on the altar. That first moment where you hear the voice of God and it sounds clear, and it's like, this is what you need to do. If you are going to make this the most important thing in your life, do it.
And how did it change your life then?
I try to be the best that I can.
Why are you smiling when you're answering that?
Well, it's always funny, right? It's like, What does a good Catholic look like, right? And it's like, we're all sinners in need of grace. Like, I need to go to Mass as often as I can, right? Could I go daily? Should I go daily? 100%. Do I have time to? No. But why do you believe what you believe, right? Yeah. We've been taught this.
It's tested.
I believe it. Yeah. And then, you know, like, why is Mary have such an important role in your life and in Christ's life? Why do we need the church? Why do we need to go to confession? Why? And so it became... it solidified my faith in college by getting asked these questions. And as I walked from life from, you know, being a freshman in college to now a 31-year-old dad of four, what's the most consistent thing in there, right? It's now I'm trying to love Jesus and his church as best as I can. Now I'm trying to teach my children to love Jesus and his church as best as he can. And I think, and then again, like, why I made this statement too, it's I want to be able to show my children that, like, we have to stand and walk by our faith as well. We can't just say these things. And when we do get tested, and if they ever get tested at that point, in any point in their life, I want them to know that it's okay to stand up for our faith and it's okay to do this.
For people who want to stand up for what they believe in, and this is something I asked Harrison Butker as well, from the Kansas City Chiefs, you know, maybe young guys watching you now who say, I would like to speak out in this issue or that issue. And it might not just be Catholicism, any religion or any belief, but they feel, I'm not smart enough, I'm not equipped, I can't back it up. How do you decide when to speak up and when not to speak up in certain issues?
Sure. I think you need to hear the voice of God first. I think you need to spend as much time in silence as possible. You need to go spend time in front of the Blessed Sacrament. You need to talk to people that you trust and love, whether that's a priest, loved one, or in spiritual direction. You need to really discern these certain things, because it could just be God asking you, are you willing to speak up about this? And sometimes he's just asking you, are you willing to speak up about this? And if you say yes, he might not give you an opportunity to speak up upon it, but he just wants you to be willing to do it. So.
You mean it could be just speaking amongst your friends, not putting up a tweet that is seen by 19 million people?
Right. That could be something as easy as that. Or sometimes the toughest thing is speaking to your family about it, right? 20 million people seeing a tweet is great, right? But sometimes the hardest people to evangelize and talk to are the ones closest to you.
Your faith today, how is your faith today? You talked about how it developed over the years, and how is it today? You said you're 31?
31.
Four kids?
Yes, four kids.
Are they testing your faith?
They are testing my faith, but they are adorable as heck, so it works out, it works out great. I think.
And is it one girl and three?
Three boys and one girl. The girl runs the show. She's in the middle. And, you know, it's something that my wife and I have been extremely blessed with this family. We have been given so much. And they are my entire world there, and I would do anything for them. Even if they told me to stop playing baseball today and be home with them, I would do that in an instant. So my faith is as solid as it has been in my life, and it's because of my wife being by me for our entire relationship. It's because my kids give me the hug and squeeze when I need that hug and squeeze. And it's the people that I have surrounded myself with that love me and want me to get to heaven with them.
Hey, Trevor, great meeting you.
Thank you, Colm.
Thank you so much.
There's more to this interview. You can watch Colm's complete conversation with Trevor Williams on the EWTN YouTube page. Finally, today, we celebrate the source and summit of the Christian life, the Holy Eucharist, during the Corpus Christi feast day last Sunday. Instituted by Pope Urban IV in 1264, it's a tradition held by Catholics around the world. EWTN News In-Depth gathered pictures of Corpus Christi processions from around the globe, and we share them now in our Images of the Week. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Next week, we're back with a focus on the upcoming National Eucharistic Revival and how you will be able to participate in this renewal of our faith. I hope to see you then.